Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, co-host of Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. It has been 3 days now since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. It's the 1973 decision that had provided a constitutional right to an abortion. Now, abortion remains legal in Vermont, but the Supreme Court ruling has still led to an outpouring of reactions across the state. Over the weekend, Leslie Dungess of Mendon attended a rally in support of abortion rights in Rutland.
I showed up for myself and my friends, but also for my daughter. I have a 4-year-old daughter right here. She deserves to have choices. It's a dark day. It's been an emotional day, but we're here and we're going to fight.
Monsignor John McDermott of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington told Vermont Public that he hopes the ruling leads to a culture shift and that abortions become less frequent.
We are still facing very much an uphill challenge, an uphill climb in terms of trying to, we would say, create a greater culture of life so that abortion isn't as maybe as celebrated here as it presently is.
How do you feel about the Supreme Court's decision? Today on the show, we want to create a space for you. We'll be joined by 3 guests who can provide different types of context and perspective. First, we have Lisa Holmes, an associate professor of political science at the University of Vermont. She specializes in American judicial politics, constitutional law, and gender and law. Welcome back to the show, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Bishop Christopher Coyne, the Bishop of the Diocese of Burlington, and Professor Felicia Kornbluh. She's a University of Vermont history and gender professor and chair of the board of the Planned Parenthood of Vermont Action Fund. But again, this is a space for you this hour. What kinds of conversations have you been having with friends and family in other states over the past few days? Have you attended a protest or a gathering related to abortion access? Join the conversation. Give us a call, 800-639-2211. You can also tweet us at Vermont Edition or send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Now, Lisa Holmes, you've had a couple days to sit with the news and the Dobbs decision itself. What are some elements from the court's majority opinion that stand out to you as a legal scholar?
Well, there are 2 key parts of Alito's majority opinion. One is his analysis of how Roe and Casey, the 2 key abortion decisions, were incorrectly decided in his view and the view of the other justices that sign on to that. But then the second part of his opinion is also particularly interesting, which is where he gets into his analysis of stare decisis, which is the court's respect for their own previous precedents. And that's one of the parts of his opinion of this whole decision, I think, that is a little bit confusing for people, because it's there in particular where Chief Justice John Roberts disagrees with the other conservatives. So what we essentially have here are kind of 2 different decisions going on, 2 different rulings, a 6-3 decision upholding Mississippi's abortion law, but then a 5-4 decision overturning Roe and Casey. And Roberts is the one justice that creates that difference between those 2 breakdowns.
Now, we're already getting a lot of phone calls, and we've gotten some emails as well, and I'll be reading some of those throughout the hour. I'm going to start with Robin, who writes us, "As I reflect on the SCOTUS decision that ends Roe v. Wade, I do not have an abortion story to share. Instead, I'm looking at my children who are 17 and 20 and realizing I probably would not have chosen to have children if I lived in a place without access to abortion." Robin says she has type 1 diabetes and that pregnancy is challenging and risky for her. Now, Lisa Holmes, we've received a couple of questions about the effects of this decision on the different states. And in the wake of the Dobbs decision, about half of all states either have or are expected to pass abortion bans or restrictions. And here in New England, we have a block of states that plan for now to keep abortion legal. But a listener named Sarah wrote in and asked us about the laws that could prohibit women from having an abortion in another state where it's legal. And she asked, doesn't this violate the 14th Amendment? Can you address that?
Well, I can. There is some case law pointing to a constitutional right to travel. And it is actually something that Justice Kavanaugh mentions in his concurring opinion in the Dobbs case handed down on Friday. And he refers to that issue as an easy question, that he says that his presumption is that a state trying to ban a citizen of that state from traveling to another state to procure an abortion would violate the constitutional right to travel, kind of based on the privileges and immunities of citizenship. So while, you know, lots of states are attempting to pass these kinds of laws, you know, there is going to be clear litigation, and this is one that the court is already kind of anticipating is coming, and one of the justices in the majority at least addressed in his separate opinion.
Mm. Now this decision has been years in the making in many ways. Some say it began a couple of years ago when President Trump started appointing more conservative justices. Others point to 2010, when control of state houses flipped from blue to red all across the country. When did you start to feel like the fall of Roe was something that was starting to feel inevitable in a way?
Well, the interesting thing about being a political scientist who studies courts is that we've sort of been anticipating this pretty much all along. You know, there have been big abortion decisions scattered throughout the history since Roe, where, you know, court watchers have kind of wondered, is this going to be the one? Was it going to be the Webster decision in the 80s or the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision in the 90s, for example? I would argue that this movement, of course, goes back even further than that and really started up in the 1980s with the creation of conservative groups like the Federalist Society that kind of turned their focus on the courts as a long-term game plan in American politics.
Mm. Well, speaking of the courts, on Friday, I spoke to a woman from South Carolina named Shauna Mosley Foster. I was speaking to folks on Church Street in Burlington, getting their reactions to the news from the Supreme Court. And Shauna told me her husband's a traveling surgical tech, and so they've been living in Vermont for the past couple of months. She said something really interesting to me. Let's take a listen.
I'm just sickened. Even though I'm well past that age of reproducing, however, I just feel sad for all of my son, his girlfriend, and it affects Black and brown people on a lower income scale. I mean, let's face it, rich women who want to get one will get one, and they will get one. We need to change the Supreme Court. It should not be a lifetime appointment. It should be, let's say, 10 years, just like anybody in Congress. They shouldn't be there for 40 years. I mean, because where's the new ideas and the new growth? Anyway, my two cents.
Now, that's her two cents, but that concept of term limits has come up a lot recently. Lisa Holmes with the University of Vermont, do you think the idea of term limits for justices could really go anywhere?
I think not. President Biden, when he was elected president, of course, instituted this commission to study judicial reform. And they issued a report of running kind of the gamut of different proposals out there, including court expansion, including changing the court's jurisdiction, and including this issue of term limits. You know, there's just not the votes in Congress for Democrats to achieve something like this. You know, as I've already mentioned, this is a multi-decade effort on the part of conservatives to change the composition of the Supreme Court. I think the kind of the expectation that they would just sit there and let, you know, in one kind of fell swoop, Democrats undo that by expanding the court or imposing term limits or something like that is highly, highly unlikely to happen.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, stay with us. I want to bring in a couple voices of listeners who are calling in right now. Let's start with Debbie in Essex Junction. Excuse me. Debbie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I'm just sitting here listening to some of the people already speaking, and I have some thoughts, but yes, I had an abortion back in 1980 when I attended the University of Vermont. I found myself in an unplanned pregnancy after drinking. And what I wanted to share is that I hear a woman saying something about she's sickened by hearing what this means for the her daughter and her boyfriend mm-hmm. and people with this choice. But what about her grandchild that is involved, too? And I think we're missing a whole person in there. And what happened to me is I ended up at Planned Parenthood, did not know much. I had been a virgin when I went to college. But long story short, I was directed towards an abortion. And I didn't find out until about 4 years later when I was pregnant with my son. I saw actual pictures of a 7, 8 week, 9 week, 10 week old baby, and they are distinguishedly human babies. And I think that's what's missing is we're missing the other whole person. And so I went into lots of depression, guilt, remorse. It just really takes a toll on women. And in the next few years, I was able to find forgiveness in the Lord Jesus Christ, which helped me, and I became a new creation, and I went out and helped women. And I just want to tell you, there are over 100 women in this state that I know are hurting from their abortions. I've had to deal with them on Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. I've had to go over with fights with their husband that wanted them to get the abortion because they wanted a car first that year, or they weren't ready mm-hmm. for babies yet, or whatever it was. And you know, police have been involved. I've just seen so much that I don't even know how to tell you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for calling, Debbie, and sharing your experience with us. I want to make sure we get to a couple other voices here before we have to take a break. Let's go to David in Wilmington. David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. My comment is that the USA is on its way to becoming, once again, a shining example of morality in an increasingly corrupt, evil, perverted, immoral world.
Thank you for your call, David. Let's go to Jackie in Fairfax. Jackie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Jackie from Fairfax. Thank you for taking my call. And I just want to say that you said this is our space to share our voice, so thank you for that. I was very happy to find out the news on Friday, even though abortion stays legal in Vermont, but I was conceived in rape. Back in 66, a few years before Roe v. Wade, and my life is just as valuable as everyone else's, and I'm just so grateful that abortion was not legal back then. My brother and I were adopted, and life is good, and I just want to say that a child should never have to pay for the crimes of their father, and I look to, I just retired from teaching, so now I'm getting more involved with helping women in crisis pregnancies. There's plenty of resources for you. You're not alone. And if you're looking to give up your child, there are many parents who are looking to adopt.
Thank you, Jackie. Let's go now to Merlin in Lisbon, New Hampshire. Merlin, go ahead.
Good day. Looking at the two Supreme Court rulings lately, you should have a T-shirt that says legalize guns, outlaw abortion. That way the NRA's got something more to shoot at.
All right. Thank you for your call, Merlin. Let's go back to Lisa Holmes, who is on the line with us, University of Vermont political science professor. Lisa, we're hearing folks on all sides of this issue, people who support abortion access, people who want to see it curtailed in Vermont. I'm curious what you think the future of abortion access in Vermont could look like. Now, I know you're not in the business of speculating, but could you tell us a little bit about the vote that Vermonters have ahead of them in November?
So the November vote on Proposition 5, I suspect, will be positive in terms of voting to amend the state constitution. To put reproductive liberty into the Vermont Constitution. Really what that would be doing would be securing in our state constitutional law protections that we already have in our statutory law in terms of protecting the right to have an abortion at any stage of a pregnancy, including, and even more expansively than that, in terms of other rights as well. But I would also kind of like to comment on some of the comments that have been made both in the recordings that you took and some of the callers,
please,
which is the very strong opinions that people are expressing here. You know, I think what that demonstrates is that Justice Alito, you know, argues in his majority opinion on Friday that Roe and Casey were unable to resolve the abortion debate. Well, the Dobbs decision is not going to resolve the abortion debate either. And I also could have other things to say about their discussion of the reliance interests and some of the comments that we've heard about people worrying about their children and their grandchildren. But I will throw it back to you for right now.
Right. Well, I think that's a theme we keep hearing again and again in these discussions is how polarized this debate seems to be, how it's increasingly difficult to find that middle ground. We'll be joined in our next block by a historian who can kind of take us back through the decades and tell us about when that intense politicization really began. I am curious, Lisa, what, you know, you're a professor at the University of Vermont. Are you seeing these debates play out on campus? I know school's out for the year, but is this something that brought up these same emotions, or did you feel like people were kind of on the similar sides of things in this younger cohort that you teach?
Well, in the cohort that I teach, you know, it strikes me that most of the students that I work with are decidedly pro-choice. But I can't speak for every student that I've taught in all of this, but throughout the last handful of years. But what I would also say is that there was a lot of discussion, both in the court's opinion, you know, they use sort of legalistic sounding language about reliance interests. But that's basically what a lot of your callers and speakers have been touching on when they talk about concern about the ability of young people in particular in America today and more marginalized populations in particular to kind of conduct their lives as they see fit in this climate with respect to uncertainty over the right to have an abortion. But of course, what Alito said in his majority opinion is that abortion is not a decision that people make years ahead of time. They are decisions made after people become pregnant, and therefore there is not such a strong reliance interest. But what I've heard from at least some of the people that you have spoken to is and from my own students, is the idea that that perhaps young people in particular expected this right to be there. And depending on what state they're going to be in moving forward, it may not be.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to add another voice to the conversation here, Felicia Kornblum, also of the University of Vermont. She's a professor of history and of gender, sexuality, and women's studies, and the author of the forthcoming book, A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighborhood, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice in New York and the Nation. Welcome to the show, Felicia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we should also note here that Felicia is on the board of Planned Parenthood Northern New England. Now, before we dive into some more questions, I want to read a couple more emails we've received. Andrew in Benson writes us, I'm 41 years old, and I'm the father of an intelligent, healthy, and beautiful 10-year-old girl. She has fewer rights than she did a week ago, and I'm furious. Since I was born, the powers that be in this country have been gradually granting more rights to marginalized peoples. It's been a positive progression until now. This is an inflection point. We are now regressing as a nation. Felicia, what is your response to what you've heard on this show so far, to the calls and the emails that we've received?
Well, I think some of the calls you received have been a little unrepresentative of opinion in both Vermont and the nation. In fact, public opinion is squarely in favor of a public policy and a legal approach to reproductive rights that lets people make their own choices. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone thinks that abortion is morally good or is a good healthcare choice, but we do have clear majorities of Americans who think that public policy should allow people, in consultation with their families and their doctors, to make those choices. And that's what the Roe versus Wade opinion, the decision that has now been overturned, really said. It didn't say, you know, abortion is great, although some people think abortion is great and has been great in their own lives. It did say that this is something where people have a sphere of liberty, and they should have a sphere of liberty that's protected by the Constitution, and that's appropriate. and that the government should not be able to regulate that or interfere with that. So I just wanted to make that distinction. That's true historically, and that's what we've really gone back on in this Dobbs opinion, this very long history from Roe versus Wade until now, which, and now the Supreme Court is betraying both its own precedent and public opinion by saying, no, 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 we are going to allow the states to interfere in this very intimate decision in this realm of freedom or liberty.
Lisa Holmes with UVM, what do you think of that statement that Felicia just made, that the Supreme Court is betraying public opinion? Like, what role does the Supreme Court have in honoring or taking into account public opinion, if any?
Well, Alito, in his opinion, takes this on squarely in the opinion that was handed down on Friday and says that it is, you know, not the court's job to follow public opinion. But social scientists who study courts know that as a general rule, the Supreme Court does follow public opinion, sometimes in a lagged fashion, but they can't help it but follow public opinion. So what we have right now, and Professor Kornbluh is right about this, this decision is out of step with public opinion in the United States right now. And, you know, the court can do that from time to time, but if they do that regularly and for a prolonged period of time, that starts to pose big problems for how the public views the court and how the other branches might view the court as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Felicia, you have studied the history of abortion access in the U.S. And the push to protect it in the Constitution. One thing that I think is hard to grasp today, which Lisa and I were talking about before the break, is this fact that abortion did not used to be such a partisan and political issue as it is now. Can you tell us a bit more about how that politicization began? When did it really take off?
Well, I think it happened gradually. I studied the national picture, but particularly looked at what happened in New York, because New York in 1970, so that's before Roe versus Wade, passed and implemented the most progressive abortion statute in the country. And as it happens, my mother, the late Beatrice Kornbluh Braun, wrote the first draft of that law that New York ultimately passed. So it's kind of a double story. So on the one hand, after New York passed this very progressive statute on abortion, state legislation on abortion, there was a rising movement, and it began to be associated with the Republican Party, which it never had been before. Actually, the key co-sponsor of that law was a Republican woman legislator who was also a vice president of the National Organization for Women in that state, right? So this was not a partisan political issue. After New York changed its law, then it started to be, but it really took all the way through the 70s into the early 80s for it to be fiercely partisan and really mapped onto our two major political parties. And in terms of the downfall of Roe versus Wade or the putting us on the road to where we are now, I would just add to what's already been in the conversation, the 1980 Supreme Court opinion in Harris versus McRae, which was the one that affirmed the Hyde Amendment, which allowed Congress to take away public funding for abortion under the Medicaid program, which serves low-income people and disabled people. And I think that was a very big watershed, not fully appreciated at the time. So I would say it's been happening. It really, in the 80s, it starts to be really mapped under the two political parties. And then we've seen, you know, ebbs and flows of how intense the politicization has been. And I think, you know, to some degree, that's been manipulated by forces in one of the major political parties and the Republican Party who have used this to their advantage.
Felicia Kornbluh and Lisa Holmes, stay with us for a moment. We're going to get to a couple callers now. Let's start with Sarah in Putney. Sarah, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that when I was 20, I had an abortion because I was not yet ready to be a parent. I now have two adult children, both with uteruses, and they now have less rights than I did back in 1990. And it just feels like the Supreme Court said to all of us, we are less than human. We are not fully people. We don't have access to our bodily autonomy. And we're just going the wrong way. And it feels like unless you're a white man in this country, don't expect to have any human rights.
Yeah. Sarah, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go now to Emma in Rutland. Emma, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As a young person today, I have thought a lot about how I would love to have kids one day. But if I were forced to carry a pregnancy right now because of anti-abortion laws, I would heavily consider ending my own life. And I'm scared for women in places without access to abortion or where back alley abortions fail, that this is going to be a big problem. And I don't think it's fair.
Thank you, Emma. And thank you for your honesty there. Sandy in Montpelier, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I've been come to the thought that this is so polarized and there's no room for compromise between those who believe in the right to liberty for the mother and life, and also the right to liberty and life for the child. And I'm wondering, we have to make a way forward instead of compromise, because there is no, not say that both have rights, instill both rights, and then come up with a mediated line in between. So I'm just going to throw one example out.
Sure.
If, say, at week six, up to week 15, it's up to the mother carrying the child, what she wants to do. After week 15, if those two rights come into conflict or they're at odds, could there be a guardian appointed, like we do for elderly people or people with other disabilities, that a guardian is appointed that would move on behalf of the child? A key part of that would be that whoever takes guardianship of the child would then be responsible for the welfare of both the mother and the child. So we've got to solve this problem. It's tearing our country apart.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Sandy. Felicia,
can I say something on that point?
Yes, yeah. Yes, please. I was going to go to you next. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring back Roe versus Wade itself. And thank you. Thanks to everyone who called. But on that last point in particular, I understand this might not be satisfying, but I would just encourage people to read the original Roe versus Wade opinion, because it itself enacts that kind of compromise, right? And I've been in the papers of Justice Blackmun, who's the author of that opinion, and I've sort of followed his path in the research he did in writing it, and that was exactly what he was attempting to do. That was why in Roe versus Wade, there was a three trimester formula, and in each trimester of a pregnancy, there was a different balance that he and the majority enacted between what the state could do and what the individual was free to do. And, you know, in the current opinion, Justice Alito kind of makes fun of that and calls it badly argued and blah, blah, blah. I actually think it's quite artful. It was quite artful as a way to try and express the ambivalence of many Americans and the ambivalence of the justices on the Supreme Court, the ambivalence that had been expressed in the lower federal courts and in the state legislatures. And that now is gone. What we're going to get are, you know, our state laws in many states, half of American states, that are not going to allow for that sort of balancing and that sort of compromise. And so that's one of the things that I mourn today.
Mm. Lisa Holmes, one of the elements of this decision that has been making headlines recently is Clarence Thomas's concurrence. Could you speak to that a little bit? What did we learn from Justice Thomas's concurrence that has gotten some folks on the left quite concerned?
Well, I can understand that because this is a sort of a classic Thomas concurrence where he writes something that demonstrates no one else signs on to it. This is him writing alone, but he demonstrates that he is immediately willing to go much further than even the other conservative justices on the Supreme Court. So basically, Thomas takes a shot at the entire notion of what's called substantive due process, which is reading substantive rights into the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. And in particular, Thomas highlights three decisions that he thinks should be reconsidered. The Griswold versus Connecticut decision from 1965 that said that there was a constitutional right to contraception. The Lawrence versus Texas decision from the 90s about sexual behavior and the privacy of your own home. And of course, the Obergefell decision from a handful of years ago on marriage equality. Thomas specifically says that all of those decisions should be reconsidered in the wake of the Dobbs decision on Friday.
Thank you. Let's go back to the phones here for just a moment with Dan in St. Johnsbury. Dan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Right. Thank you for the conversation. I think this is an egregious attack on human rights. And when I hear the pro-life argument that life is precious, I wonder about the fact that there are 4.2 million youth and children experiencing homelessness in the U.S. We're one of the only countries that hasn't signed on to the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child. So I guess my question is for either the state of Vermont GOP or the federal GOP, where is the platform that provides pro-quality of life now that we're in this situation with women and reproductive rights?
Thank you. Felicia, I'm wondering if you have any response to Dan's comment there.
Oh, I think that's an excellent point. And I think that the answer is to work on both, that people who care about the lives of both adults and children should work to have policies that respect people's liberty in the realm of choosing not to have children, whether that's access to contraception or whether it's access to a safe, legal, affordable abortion. And we should work on what I see as the other side of the coin, which is the ability to have children and to have those children live in dignity and with well-being. And I think that for some years, we were stronger on the liberty side and not so strong on the well-being side. And really, I think, and now we've taken a step back on liberty, but I think we need both. And we really need a robust commitment, to granting people access to housing and healthcare and all the things that are necessary to thrive for parents and children. And so that people can really make those choices. We have no idea what it would look like, how many abortions there would be, how many IUDs people would have, how many children people would have, if people genuinely had the opportunity to make those choices in a robust way. And some of the people I write about were making this argument even in the 1970s. And I think it's time for us to pay attention.
Let's go now to Pamela in Arlington. Pamela, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I have not heard any comments about a man's role in getting a woman pregnant. I think punishment for men who commit incest or rape should be greater. And I think those men should be responsible for the cost of the woman delivering the child and raising the child until the child is 18 years old, even if the child is adopted. The woman should not have to pay for the crime of the men. Thank you.
Thank you, Pamela. Let's go now to Amy in Richford. Amy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I have had an abortion. Actually, I had two. And they were a long time ago, right after Roe v. Wade came into play. And at the time, they didn't know a lot about ultrasounds and things like that. And I was just a college student at Kent State. And it just come in, and they made it that it wasn't important, that it was like a simple procedure, a bunch of cells, things like that. And it was no problem. Just go have your abortion and you'll walk out. Mm-hmm. And I was a pre-med major, class valedictorian, full scholarship. And after I had it and I went back to my classes and I studied a lot about embryology, I was in advanced biology, I started having severe depression, eating disorders, a lot of issues. And it went on for many, many years. I didn't go to medical school. I eventually ended up marrying the man I got pregnant with, and we had some children. But I remember telling my son as he got older that I had an abortion, and he looked at me like, would you have done it to me?
Well, Amy, thank you so much for calling and sharing your personal experience. I want to read another email that we received from from John in West Dover, who says, surely the most important requirement of any member of the judiciary is impartiality. But how can anyone with a significant religious faith be truly impartial? I believe several current justices are Catholic, some devoutly so. Does not seem right. Lisa, I'm curious what your thoughts are on John's email about the true impartiality of justices.
Well, I'm a political scientist, right? I think my answer to that question would be, it depends on what you mean by impartiality. Mm-hmm. And if you think that people are not going to bring their personal experiences, including, you know, their views on faith and morality and that kind of thing to the bench with them, you know, I think that's naive. These are people who do have their own particular preferences and biases, and political scientists tend to think that it's precisely in cases like this that those preferences kind of come out and are really leading the charge, as opposed to, you know, the flowery legalistic language that they write in their opinions. I could speak more about the role of Catholics on the Supreme Court, but I'll make one comment here, which is that, you know, in some of the recent confirmation hearings, Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee have tried to kind of try to parse that out. And it's politically very fraught, because then that opens them up to criticisms that they are engaging in anti-religious or anti-Catholic bias in terms of their questioning of nominees to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to note that we had meant to have a Bishop Christopher Coyne of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington on the show today. Unfortunately, we had a bit of a timing snafu, and he will not be able to join us. But hopefully we will be able to incorporate their position further into this conversation on Vermont Public in the future. Felicia, Lisa and I talked a little bit earlier in the show about Prop 5, the proposed constitutional amendment here in Vermont that would enshrine the right to quote-unquote reproductive liberty in the Vermont state constitution. Could you speak to us a bit about the development of this amendment? It's been a couple years in the making, is that right?
Yes, and I want people to be very clear. When you look at your ballot in November, to vote for it, it will not be called Proposition 5. That's what it was called in the legislature. It will be called the Reproductive Liberty Amendment, or Article 22 of the Vermont Constitution. So look for that. And it's something that has very strong backing so far. And it has to be, because that's the way we amend our Constitution in Vermont. So it had to be approved twice in two separate biennia. You know, we have these two-year-long legislative sessions. So we had to go to two-year-long legislative sessions and approve it in both houses. And it's gone through that process, which is wonderful. But I want to encourage people, first of all, to go to our website for the Vermont Reproductive Liberty Amendment. And so you can really read the full text and take some time with it. And you can also learn more about it and learn who the sponsors are. And you can find a place where you can donate to support the campaign, which is happening from now through November, and you can volunteer, and you can pledge your own support and your own willingness to vote for the Reproductive Liberty Amendment. And I think we're going to be the first, if we pass it in November, Vermont will be the first state in the United States, in the history of the United States, to enshrine reproductive liberty in our state constitution, and that protects us, and it protects generations going forward.
And there are a couple other states right now that are working to get a similar constitutional amendment on the ballot in November. Michigan, California, I believe. Let's go now to Nicole in Randolph. Nicole, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a mom, a former Catholic, and a special educator. And I have always personally ascribed to the belief that if a woman doesn't think she can care for a child, we should believe her. And what I do know for a fact is that there are grave perils associated with not believing her. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Nicole. Let's go to Norman in Essex Junction. Norman, go ahead.
Hi, this is Norm Smith. And I just want to point out that all this discussion about Roe v. Wade and its effect doesn't apply here in Vermont. We have Act 47, which basically says the government cannot restrict or even regulate abortions. And the proposed amendment is so overbroad, nobody even really knows what reproductive autonomy means. So I would urge people to vote against it. I'm also a bit offended by having someone try to do fundraising during this program for the pro-amendment people. I don't think that's right. This is supposed to be a news program, not a campaign to raise money. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for your call, Norman. Lisa, can you address Norman's point about the broadness of the language in the Reproductive Liberty Amendment? I've spoken to some of the folks who helped craft that language in the State House, and I do believe that was, you know, one of the goals, to keep the language broad. What are some of the, pros and cons of that type of language in a constitutional amendment?
Well, the language is broad, and as you indicated, I think that was the intention, right? It indicates that an individual's right to personal reproductive autonomy is central to the liberty and dignity to determine one's own life course. So the expectation would be that this would apply to abortion rights, but also, you know, the right to get pregnant, the right to contraception, the protection against forced sterilization, perhaps others as well. I suspect that Felicia has a lot more background in this area than I do in terms of this specific amendment. But as you indicated, the broadness was not a bug, it was a feature of this amendment in terms of its intention.
Hmm. We also got an email from Barbara in Middlebury who says, I'm concerned that because a fetus represents the reproductive activity of a man and a woman, this means the courts will eventually be asked to weigh the extent to which a man's reproductive autonomy is being denied when a woman's decision to have or not have an abortion goes against his wishes. Felicia, thoughts there?
I think there may be some issues like that, but I'd like to go back to the RLA for a second, the Reproductive Liberty Amendment, and just to make it very clear that this is not arbitrary or overbroad legal language. In fact, the amendment was crafted very carefully in consultation with eminent leaders and scholars of state constitutional law, and it was crafted in a very particular way. Each term has a specific legal and constitutional meaning. So I wouldn't want anyone to be concerned on that score. And it is intended to encompass people's liberty not to be forced to abort, not to be forced into a sterilization procedure. And we do have a history of that, even in Vermont and across the country. It was also intended to speak to the rights of same-sex couples and trans and non-binary and queer people. So for all those reasons, I think it's very, very important. And I would also say that there are concerns which are separate from that about and have been for some years about a so-called men's rights movement, which might see itself empowered in the overturning of Roe versus Wade.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lisa, I'm wondering if you can then respond to this email from Barbara. I can reiterate part of it. She asks about how, you know, since a fetus represents the quote unquote reproductive activity of a man and a woman, she's concerned about whose opinion will be held more highly. Do you think that the Reproductive Liberty Amendment kind of equally protects a male and female's opinion and reproductive autonomy?
That's an interesting question that really, off the top of my head like this, I'm not comfortable answering.
That's fair.
Well,
let's go to a question from Lisa, who asked, President Biden said rights like same-sex marriage and access to contraception could be threatened in the wake of Dobbs. Do you think that's true, given the current Supreme Court makeup? Lisa.
Could you repeat the beginning part of that question again?
Yeah, so her concern is about, her question is about President Biden's statements, I believe, on Friday, saying that rights like same-sex marriage and access to contraception, to birth control pills, could be threatened. And do you think that's true?
Yeah. Well, I think it's absolutely true that those challenges are going to be coming. Alito tries to explain in his majority opinion in the Dobbs case that this is a one-off decision on the issue of abortion, and abortion is distinct from all of those other issues that are predicated on this substantive due process idea that we talked about a little bit earlier. Kavanaugh also reiterates that in his concurring opinion. But as I said, Thomas disagrees and says, no, we should be reconsidering basically all of this. And I fully expect that these challenges are going to come. And then it's just a matter of what this, you know, majority on the Supreme Court thinks about the historical basis of things like the right to contraception or same-sex marriage or interracial marriage, for example.
Mm. And we have time for one or two more calls here. Let's go to Marilyn in Middletown Springs. Marilyn, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I very much support the right for abortion, and I think this is a dark time for women's rights. But I'm calling to respond to comments from a couple of listeners who said how much they regretted abortions they had in the past. Mm-hmm. I think that it's always possible to second-guess all decisions we made in the past, if only. But at the time we make the decision, including abortion, we knew exactly what we were doing. And I think it's disingenuous for these people to say they didn't know what a fetus looked like, because there was tons of information. I had a child in 1968. I knew exactly what he looked like every minute of his in utero life. So I think she didn't know, or they didn't know, because they didn't want to know, and they made the right decision at the time for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Marilyn. Some final thoughts from each of our guests. Felicia Kornbluh, what do you think the likelihood is that the Reproductive Liberty Amendment is going to pass in November?
Well, I think we have strong support in Vermont, and thank you, Vermonters, for that, as the chair of the Planned Parenthood of Vermont Action Fund Board. But I think we have the opportunity to have a blowout victory. And I think that would really make a difference. So I would just encourage everyone again to go to our Reproductive Liberty Amendment website to learn about it. And if you're so moved to volunteer and to donate and participate and to vote, because I think that could make a huge difference, not just for us, but for the whole country.
Thank you. And same question to you, Lisa, as well. What will you be keeping an eye on during election season this year?
Well, during election season, I'm going to be looking into what this state of affairs, you know, does in terms of support for one political party or the other. I think it's still pretty clear that the expectation is that at the national level, it's a tough election cycle for Democrats. That's always true in a midterm election. Here in Vermont, I agree largely with what Professor Kornbluh has said about the prospects of the Reproductive Liberty Amendment. That's what I would be looking for come November.
That was UVM political science professor Lisa Holmes. Thanks so much for joining the program again.
Thank you for having me.
And Felicia Kornbluh is a UVM professor of history and of gender, sexuality, and women's studies. Felicia, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.